welcome to Talking Beats with Daniel Lalchuk. That's me, and I'm so glad you're here. If you like what we do, I'd love it if you gave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you're so compelled, write a review. That really helps, and maybe tell a friend or family member. They might like the show as much as you do. If you want to get involved in the program, visit our website, talkingbeats.com, and click Support the Show, where you can make either a one-time or a recurring donation. As we look to continue having cliche-free conversations of real substance with a diverse range of the world's most compelling people, your support is so appreciated, especially as we look to expand and increase our offerings. If you have a question, comment, or thought, find us on social media, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, or if you wish to reach out directly, email me at daniel@talkingbeats.com. I'm so glad you're here. Let's get on with today's conversation. On today's program, we're speaking with nature and science writer Cynthia Barnett. She's been chronicling our physical and natural world for years. She's written books like Mirage, Florida and the Vanishing Water of the Eastern U.S., Blue Revolution, Unmaking America's Water Crisis, and Rain. That's right, Rain, a Natural and Cultural History. She's out with a new book called The Sound of the Sea, Seashells and the Fate of the Oceans. It's her love letter and her plea for us in the public to pay more attention to the oceans via telling the history of seashells, something that she claims has fascinated our human ancestors for more than 100,000 years. I'm pleased she's joining me right now to talk beauty and fragility of the oceans. Cynthia Barnett, welcome.
Daniel, thank you so much for having me on Talking Beats. I'm excited.
Why do we like shells? Everybody from a little kid who first picks up a shell and is fascinated to someone your level, an expert, a collector. Why do we like shells that come from the sea, from the beach?
There's something incredibly satisfying about them in both the feel, right? The feel and the incredible visual patterns. So I open the book with imagining a Neanderthal girl walking a beach in Spain and picking up seashells. Anthropologists and archaeologists know that Neanderthals collected shells for something beyond food, because they found these stashes of seashells in caves that were clearly picked up when they were empty. So there, it is just like even pre-humans really were attracted to seashells, and I think there is something about them that stretches back through human time and memory. And in our case, you know, perhaps to our own childhoods, in these nice memories that you have on vacation, walking the beach with your grandparents, which was my case, or you know, discovering these incredibly beautiful objects in nature and their patterns, including spiral patterns which the human eye is very much drawn to. So I think there's all kinds of wonderful reasons why we love seashells. And it's my sense that they're one of the most collected and beloved objects in nature. And that's one of the reasons why I decided to write about them, even though the book is really a subtext for much else besides seashells. It was my sense that they're a really wonderful way to draw people to the story of what's happening to the ocean and to the environment.
How do we know Neanderthals collected them? Isn't that a strange thing to do when just staying alive past the age of 15 is a challenge?
The scientists I interviewed didn't see it as a strange thing to do. No, they saw it as wonderfully natural. And the way they know that they collected them is that if a seashell has been gathered for food with the living animal inside, it may still be fairly smooth when you find it in an archaeological context. But these seashells found in the Neanderthal caves had clearly bumped along the shore empty. They had the marks of having been in the sea for a long time or having bumped along rocks and so on. They also have a keenly uniform pattern. So they might have, you know, they might all have the exact same little hole in the top. So they might have been collected for jewelry making or to hold little kinds of cosmetics or other kinds of pigments. So there are all kinds of reasons why Neanderthals or others might have collected empty shells. And it really could have been just kids having fun and loving seashells in the way we do today.
Talk about your beginning passions for the ocean, for seashells. And why is Florida such a special place for all of this? What is it about Florida?
Well, my idea, I was born in Florida. I do come from Florida. I grew up in both Florida and California, so had, you know, wonderful memories of collecting seashells with my grandmothers, although I haven't ever been a rabid shell collector of the sort I write about in this book. And Florida is important to the story as sort of the apex of the story. So the apex is the little pointy top of a shell where the marine mollusk begins the work of shell building. So that little pointy top is where the mollusk lived when it was born before it began winding the shell and making it bigger and bigger and bigger. So I thought of Florida as the apex or center of the story, but the book goes all over the world to tell the story of marine mollusks and seashells and humanity, and to get to this issue of what's happening to the ocean. And I should back up a moment too and tell you what's important about Florida. It was where I had the idea. I had been invited to a little seashell museum on Sanibel Island called the Bailey Matthews National Shell Museum to talk about a previous book. And while I was there, I learned a statistic that absolutely floored me. They had surveyed visitors to find out how much they already knew about seashells. And these surveys showed that 90% of visitors, many of them children who were visiting Florida with their parents, didn't know that a seashell was built by a living animal. Many of them thought that they were stones or rocks. So that's when I got the idea that, wow, you know, it was so disturbing to me that we are so disconnected from nature and from the oceans, and especially children would be that disconnected. So I thought it struck me as this incredible metaphor for the ocean itself, just like we've loved seashells for their beautiful exterior rather than the life inside, we've also loved the oceans as the beautiful backdrop of life, or almost as a postcard, rather than understanding the oceans as the source of life. And now, of course, the source of the expression of so much of our harm to the environment through climate change and other impacts. So I really thought seashells would be a perfect way to get at that story metaphorically. And of course, as it relates to your own interest and your own beat, this idea of listening, right? We always wanted to listen to seashells. And it was my sense that, you know, the amazing thing about that is how often they did lead to truth. So in the scientific revolution time, for example, and even before, seashells on mountaintops gave earlier people signs that the sea had once covered the land. Fossil seashells like the ammonites gave scientists clues about evolution and extinction and geologic change. And in all kinds of ways in human history, seashells really did lead us to know something. I describe them as the world's great fact checkers, Daniel, because in both the human story and Native American stories and so on, and in the scientific story, they hold the historical archive and, carry the story of what's happened far more accurately than the humans who got to write it down.
Indeed, speaking about listening, you quote William Wordsworth, the great poet and the narrator. You quote, after falling asleep near the sea, he's dreaming, and he holds a seashell to his ear and hears, quote, a loud prophetic blast of harmony, an ode in passion uttered, which foretold destruction to the children of the earth by deluge now at hand. That's Wordsworth. And you do write that seashells do not really echo their native ocean, as people have believed for centuries, nor do they foretell coming storms, as old superstition had it. Contrary to a more modern theory still found in some kids' fact books, they don't magnify the sound of blood through our veins. And you continue, no, the poet Wordsworth got much closer to the science when his narrator held the shell to his ear and heard his own mind's fear. What's happening here? What's
right.
happening? Explain.
Right. Yeah, I was amazed. A friend of mine who is a literature professor, Dave Walter, told me about the Wordsworth stanza, and I was really moved by it. And in this book, a lot of times, the poets are seeing something that the scientists don't quite see yet. And I found that so fascinating. But anyway, a large spiraled shell like a conch, whelk, or the sacred chank in India is simply the perfect resonating chamber. It's like having a hand cupped to your ear. It's simply picking up the ambient noise in the environment. So it amplifies exactly what's going on around us. And I thought that was a neat metaphor too. As it amplifies sound, it is also the seashells themselves and the animals that build them are telling us something about what's happening in the ocean. So I have to say I was amazed at how often I wrote about sound in a book that's devoted to silent animals. It was just amazing to me. And I love that. That's one of the angles that I really appreciate. And Daniel, my last book was Rain's biography. I wrote a book called Rain, A Natural and Cultural History. And in that book too, I wrote a lot about sound, and it wasn't something I was expecting to do. But as you think about rain, you can imagine why sound was so important to that book. But it was even more surprising in the seashell book that sound is a big part of the story, and in fact ended up being a part of the title of the book, The Sound of the Sea.
I'd like to go back to something you said earlier. You were talking about the lack of knowledge among many people who didn't know that shells were created by a living animal. You also talked about how many people simply love the ocean. You referred to it as a postcard, but didn't truly understand what was happening environmentally, what humans were doing to the ocean, how the oceans were changing. And I wanted to ask you, what's wrong with that? Why can't, in an age of problems, pandemic, economic problems, lots of issues for everybody, why can't we just simply like the ocean, think it's beautiful, and have that be enough?
I think it's super important to like the ocean and feel inspired by it and have it as a place where you can go to recharge and hear the sound of the sea and meditate on that beautiful postcard scene. But the reason it isn't enough is that humanity has reached the point where our actions are changing the sea itself. Climate change is literally changing the chemistry of the ocean. So in this little specific story I'm telling, it's making it more difficult for mollusks to build their shells and weakening some shells. So marine mollusks build their shells by taking up minerals from the surrounding environment, from the sea. And this phenomenon called ocean acidification is making it more difficult to build their shells. But on a much larger scale, climate change is acidifying the seas, warming the seas. This is having an extraordinary impact on the entire oceans and our way of life, the seafood we eat, and beyond that, of course, the impacts that it's having on land now, the heat wave we're seeing in the West, the things we're seeing now on the continents are things that have already been happening for the ocean in the oceans for a long time. The oceans have really been protecting us from a lot of the climate change. They've absorbed 90% of the additional heat and 30% of the carbon dioxide we've put into the atmosphere. So they're 30% more acidic today than at the start of the industrial era. So I think it's important to still enjoy the ocean and to do all the things we love to do in the ocean. That's all vital for humanity. But I think it's important to do so with the knowledge of what's happening beneath the waves. And the reason that's so important is because there are changes we can make. There are things we can do that if people don't know, they won't insist on these systematic changes that we need to get to.
Systematic changes. Okay, maybe we can get there eventually. Let's talk seafood for a moment, something you mentioned. You down in Florida, there's a lot of wonderful seafood in the Gulf. There's a wonderful everything from shrimp to tuna to marlin to red snapper and all the rest, famous off the coast of New England, where I am right now, wonderful fish, although fewer species now than there were, but I don't know if that's related to acidity, the changing ocean. A lot of it, that was overfishing, and obviously great fish out west as well. So I go to the market. I see lots of great seafood, some local, some flown in from all over the world. I'm happy. It's great. What's wrong?
So I should step back for a moment and say in this book, I've tried hard not to be dogmatic or judgmental about eating seafood. And I approach it as I am, as an ordinary person trying to figure out how to live better, how to live in a way that doesn't deplete resources, you know, as all of us who care about these things and are fretting about these things are trying to do. I grew up eating seafood. Throughout this book, I'm you know, trying seafood. And from the time my kids were little, we would go scalloping in the Gulf of Mexico and gather buckets full of wild scallops. When I was a kid, I went conking with my father and gathered live conchs to make conch chowder. So in all of throughout this book, I am, you know, thinking about all of that and reporting on it and understanding the impact we've had. So both wild scallops and queen conchs are seriously overfished and pressured in the parts of the world where they live. But there's an interesting intersectionality with climate change. None of this is one thing. It's not just that we've over-harvested seafood. It's that we've over-harvested seafood and the oceans are warming and the oceans are becoming more acidic. Where you are, the plight of the wild scallops has a lot to do with the warming of the oceans. And every year, the scallop harvest is getting more and more difficult, the warmer it's getting. So all of that said, there are some really amazing and successful aquaculture efforts happening around the world. And one can envision a future where we set aside large swaths of the ocean, which scientists say is really going to be necessary both to protect the marine life in the ocean and to stem climate change. You can see us protecting large swaths in the ocean and things like seagrass that absorb as much carbon dioxide or more than the great forests on land. The mangroves at the shore, same thing. And that we grow shellfish, that we farm shellfish in the ocean, which is it's a clean industry. Shellfish clean up water as they grow. Scientists sometimes call them the liver of our rivers because they filter things and keep the water clean. And they're cleaner. These are cleaner operations than growing fish and shrimp. And so they really are, shellfish are in a lot of ways a part of the solution to the climate change challenges that we face. But again, I tried to approach this as a person, you know, really trying to figure this out, a person who loves seafood and grew up eating it and wants to think about how we do this, how we make these changes. And it really is possible. And seashells were kind of a neat way to be able to show people that, again, without hitting anyone over the head.
Well, I appreciate that. It's nice to be a little less dogmatic than some, because God knows we're all lectured all the time in real life and on social media about everything from A to Z. So a little less lecturing and maybe a little more showing of the passion as a way to convey a message is more effective and, frankly, a little more pleasant sometimes. So
I do find that, and to me it's also more honest. I think a lot of there was a late environmental writer in Florida named Bill Belville who used to fret a lot about what he described as eco ninnies, that the message is just completely shut out if one is too preachy. And I think about this a lot. I teach environmental journalism at the University of Florida. And I think a lot about how to draw broader audiences and how to write, you know, beyond the environmental choir. That's not the most important audience. The most important audience is another audience who may not be naturally drawn to an environmental book, but they might certainly love the beach or seashells. So I really think a lot about audience and tone and how to be welcoming to a new audience rather than shut people down. So we know a couple of things. One is that people shut down with a really dark message, and this story can be very dark, and I get as depressed about it as the next person. But we know that they also stop reading if a piece is too preachy. So these are all things I'm very conscious of and I think about a lot. But I'm also just a person who, you know, makes mistakes like everyone else, and you know, probably over harvested scallops even when my kids were little and we used to go out, just with this wonderful idea that, wow, the sea is so beautiful and abundant and these are always going to be there. And at that time, I didn't know that they wouldn't always be there. And part of this is a process of us all learning together that these animals are not only, they're not always going to be there, and what we can do together.
Well, are scallops disappearing?
Scallops are disappearing. They're disappearing in your part of the world, and they're disappearing in my part of the world. And again, some of it is over harvesting. But some of it is the warming of the sea. Some of it is the loss of their wonderful seagrass habitats. So seagrasses are really important. They're as important as coral reefs, and they are home to a lot of juvenile marine animals and larvae, and they're being destroyed inland all over Florida when Florida was developed, and also up the eastern seaboard. We would take out seagrass and mangroves to build waterfront and oceanfront properties, and I think it's really changing now. This awareness is changing. There's been a lot of seagrass restoration and efforts to turn this around. But again, it's something to be aware of and to understand that we need to get better at all of this to try to bring the scallops back. And it's uncertain whether they will be able to come back. It will also depend on stopping the warming and the acidification of the oceans.
Taking out mangrove is not so nice to hear. I used to go visit my grandparents in Naples. They used to live there in the wintertime and always walk through the great mangrove orchard or forest?
Forest. They're forests. Aren't they wonderful?
They're absolutely. The boardwalks go through and you see all different sorts of nature, and it's not anything that is able to be found in other parts of the country. It's not at all like a Louisiana swamp or something like that. It's its own thing, a mangrove forest. Yeah,
a mangrove forest is its own thing and an amazing thing. And they are found around the world in the subtropics, and they like you said, they're just a fantastical forest with these wonderful legs. And there are some certain oysters that grow on those legs too. And they are really important for absorbing carbon emissions and also keeping us safe from storms. And so Florida did destroy an extraordinary number of mangroves in the development patterns of the 20th century. And some of that is being restored now. And it's really seen more frequently as a solution to some of the climate threats, both from increasing hurricanes and sea rise, but also for absorbing carbon. So, you know, hopefully these things are starting to happen around the world and will happen more so as people understand how important ecosystems such as mangroves and seagrass are.
Cynthia Barnett, you mentioned something earlier. You mentioned the word listening. It's one of my favorite words. You probably know that. Listening is the key to music. Listening to oneself, listening to one's colleagues, listening to the sounds and the colors and the different shades that a great player, a great singer can make on an instrument. What do you like to listen to other than shells? What music do you listen to?
I'm a little intimidated to answer this question from someone like you who who knows music so well and who plays music so beautifully, but I'm just going to overcome my embarrassment about this answer and tell you very honestly, I have a 17-year-old daughter, and we all had a hard year between me finishing this book and her having to go through high school during the pandemic, and we decided to take off together for a road trip. We had a mother-daughter road trip to an island called Jekyll Island on the coast of Georgia, and she's a typical 17-year-old teenager who keeps me at an arm's distance, and when we got in the car, she had made me a playlist. She had made a playlist for our road trip on Spotify, and I was so moved. I was so moved, Daniel, that she had made me this playlist that I've just been listening to it ever since we got back. So I'm actually listening to teenager music now, and some of it, I'm looking at it now. One of the songs even has the word teen in it, 18 by Khalid. And she really likes an artist called Lana Del Rey, who I like a lot. My 19-year-old son listens to her too. And I've just loved the songs on this playlist, and I've been listening to them over and over. And they're kind of teenagerish, but I love them so much. One is called National Anthem by Lana Del Rey, and I like it a lot. Some of them are too cheesy to even tell you, but I just really appreciate having teenagers and being part of their music. I've always liked their music at any age that they were, but there was something that I particularly appreciated about this. So I share that with you, as cheesy as it is.
Not at all. I'm glad you shared it. I'm glad you shared it. I think it's wonderful for a parent and a child to bond over any kind of music. And it reminded me of Michael Singh, who was on here recently. He's the director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. And when I asked him, he said, well, you know what? I've been on with my, I think he said, 10-year-old son on TikTok, and we've been listening to sea shanties done by some guy in New Zealand.
I love those sea shanty tunes too. I got in on the whole sea shanty TikTok craze.
You did too.
Well,
I'd never heard of it.
I had
no idea it was a thing until April. Never connected sea shanties to TikTok. I don't have TikTok, although I've been encouraged to get it. But I don't have it. So I never was privileged enough to watch those shanties. What are they like?
They're just jaunty and wonderful. They put a big smile on your face. So I really enjoyed the sea shanty. And the other thing that's happened, my son is a freshman at Leiden University in The Hague. So he, living in Europe, he's been exposed, and from the friends he's around, he's exposed to a lot more like Dutch pop and French pop. So he will make playlists. So like he'll make a playlist of French pop and share that with me and his dad. And we all have a shared Spotify that now we're sharing around the world. And I just love that. Even though it's pop music, it's really great. And I find myself listening to French pop on my walk sometimes. And I just really appreciate being able to share that with the kids.
You listen to that on your walk, you mean in place of listening to Talking Beats?
I admit that I try to listen to podcasts on my walk, but then I think, you know, I just need some French pop. I need a little more pop in my stuff.
Well, you can send me the Spotify link, and I'll listen to some of it, and you can educate me on all of that as well via the Spotify playlist.
Okay, that sounds great. I also when my Rain book came out, I always loved rain songs, and I had a lot of rain songs in my past, like, you know, I Can't Stand the Rain by Ann Peebles, and just some great classic rock songs. And I had and still have a really nice rain playlist with my favorite 25 rain songs. I haven't really been able to do that with Seashells. Seashells wasn't, you know, it wasn't quite the same inspiration for music, again, because the animals themselves are so quiet. But like I said, it's been pretty amazing to learn about seashells as musical instruments and be able to appreciate them for the sound that they make. That part has been neat.
The overarching message of this book is passion for the sea and concern, without being dogmatic, as you mentioned. What is a distillation of where we're going regarding the sea, regarding the ocean that we all love to stand in front of or go surfboarding in, or maybe even swimming if it's a shark and stingray free, or walking as we roll up our pants up to sort of the mid-calf area and walking and having it splash on our ankles? You know, what's happening?
Yeah. So I will tell you something that happened with this book. It's my fourth book, and a theme emerged here so much more strongly than it had in my previous books. And that is, I set out to listen to seashells and what they had to say about nature and the oceans. But as it turned out, they had as much to say about people. So in art and architecture and in life-saving science, they sort of revealed the best of humanity, but they also revealed us at our worst. So I devote a chapter, each chapter is a different iconic seashell. So for example, I devote a chapter to the money cowrie. The money cowrie was the first global money. It was traded, you know, before dollar, before coin. People traded these little gleaming seashells around the world, and they actually purchased a third of the enslaved Africans who were forced to the Americas. So I did a lot of international reporting for this book before COVID, of course, and I ended up traveling from the Maldives, where they were harvested, to the coast of West Africa to tell the story of cowries. And it really was revelatory. And seashells were in so many different chapters. It revealed a story of human injustice. And that theme really stood out. By the end of the book, it stood out to me that overcoming our human inequalities and injustices is really fundamental to work on climate change and other environmental tipping points. So where I have, and I think a lot of environmental reporters have over time, you know, focused on the stories of animals or the sea or, you know, whatever topic we were writing about, the more important story for all of us to help this understanding and to help fix what's broken is to put the humanity at the center. And so that's really the big message of this book. By the time you get to the end, that's what Seashells showed me. So that to me is the big theme. But I think to answer your question specifically on sort of how we live, I think it goes back to our conversation about scallops and maybe how we see abundance. When I was younger, I might have looked at those scallops and thought, you know, my definition was of abundance would be collecting all of those wonderful scallops and having a heap of them in a bucket or a heap of them on a dinner plate. And I think the idea is to have a new definition for abundance, right? Abundance meaning abundant wildlife itself, abundant clean water, abundant seagrass and the mangroves that we've talked about, really comes down to, can we live well without burning fossil fuels and exploiting people and over-harvesting seafood and destroying habitats? And I believe fundamentally that we can, based on this long arc of human history and ingenuity, but we need to do it systematically and not, you know, not in these little pieces of one person or one place fixing this little postcard of mangroves or that population of scallops. It really needs to be a bigger effort.
Are there organizations you like that focus on this kind of thing where we can go online and do some Googling and say, oh, they're really doing some good. Here's $20 or here's $25,000.
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of great organizations doing a lot of great things. And I think organizations committed to restoration and conservation, restoring wetlands, restoring seagrass, restoring mangroves, all of that. But really, it is going to come down to the society, the governments and corporations reducing our fossil fuel use and our other kinds of extraction and exploitation. It really, you know, to me, the issue is that we've got to get beyond the work that is just being done by the NGOs and put pressure in whatever way we can, from voting to letting our elected officials know what's important to us and ensure that we take these bigger steps. And when you look back at the past, these are things that we've been able to do before. I mentioned that I wrote a book of rain, and you know, acid rain is kind of a really nice example of a time when we globally came together to fix a problem. And then if you look here at the United States, 2022 will be the 50th anniversary of the Clean Water Act, and that, you know, that was such an important step for making big changes in industrial pollution that was going straight into our waterways. And we did do a lot of good then. And I think it's important to remember those stories and know that this can be done and not feel so discouraged that we are paralyzed and unable to take action.
And a lot of what you're talking about has to come from people like you in the classroom too, raising these issues with students and making them aware that something needs to be done. And
yes.
So there's a new generation of folks out there who are concerned and who are passionate.
Yeah, I feel quite heartened by the coming generation. I get to be around the journalism students among them, and they're terrific. We've actually seen an increase in the number of journalism students nationally, which is a great thing. And these are some of the really idealistic and hardworking students I get to be around. But generally, I have a lot of faith in the next generation. At the same time, I don't want to put all of this on their heads. I really want to work beside them. And I feel like people our age should roll up our sleeves and be right there with them and not leave it to them.
Well, that's interesting to think about. And I think the passion and the drive someone like you has certainly is enough to take you through a lifetime. So I don't think you'll be going anywhere anytime soon. and keeping up the fight and also keeping up the education that you're doing. And this book is a big part of that. And maybe next time we can talk about the Rain book, which sounds equally as intriguing. But the book I'm holding in my hand now, a new book, The Sound of the Sea, Seashells and the Fate of the Oceans. Lots in here, lots to think about. Cynthia Barnett, I indeed thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been really fun to talk with you, and I will send you my Spotify playlist.
Absolutely, and it'll get some great listening, I guarantee you.
Okay, thank you.
This and more on Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk. And check us out on social media, where the conversation is always on.